Paranormal Truth and Reality with host Chris Houston. A show for those with a passion for the paranormal. And now, welcome to the show.
Welcome to Paranormal Truth and Reality. I'm your host, Christopher Houston, and we're here with a very special guest, Carrie Haggard, who is a renowned author. He's done many, many books and many different things. We brought him on because he did a very interesting book called The Traveler, which covers some unique history and a unique point of view that he created throughout his writing. And I'm going to let you get into a little bit more detail on the book, Carrie, so that we can kind of break it down and discuss it a little bit and so forth. But welcome to the show.
Hey, Chris. Thank you. Well, I'm glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your book and what made you decide to write about the subject. And then, of course, once we're finished with that, we'll get into some of the other books that you write so that everybody knows you're kind of a multitasking author, so to speak. But you've got some wonderful work. So let's just start with The Traveler and we'll run from there.
Well, Traveler, and it's the name of the title of the book is Traveler. And it talks about, and it's based on the historical, it's a historical fiction book based on the April 17th, 1897 Aurora, Texas alien crash. Now, what I found so fascinating about this was it was 50 years before Roswell, and although Roswell is world famous, very few people had ever heard of the Aurora crash. So, I had always wanted to write a novel, and actually this was my first novel. I've done a lot of stuff with antique cars through the years, and we're actually in Pittsburgh doing a television show on antique cars called Wheels of the Past. But the novel Traveler is a historical fiction book about the Aurora crash and the fictional hunt for him for the buried alien 100 years later.
And now the crash itself, I know that it was an incident April 1897, if I do believe, according to the locals, where listeners, so that you know, a UFO supposedly crashed near a farm in Aurora, Texas. The incident actually didn't get much claim until the 80s and 90s, really, when a couple of TV shows decided to revisit it. And again, in about 2005, a television show looked at it a little bit. So it's kind of a very unique story. That not only got overlooked, it did have some press, but it was mostly like the local news and so forth, if I remember right. The UFO actually comes down on the edge of the farm, and if I remember right, doesn't it clip a water well or a water tower or something when it comes down, and then it hits the ground away from the farm itself where the farmer finds the alien body?
Yes, what happened was it was like 6 o'clock in the morning. And this single alien UFO, probably no bigger than the size of a regular car, clipped the edge of a fast-moving windmill and slammed head-on into the town's water tower supply tank. And of course, the tank and the ship both exploded and littered the ground and the flower garden planted by the judge beneath and in the debris where they found the little alien dead and buried him in their local cemetery. And, this was reported in the Dallas and Fort Worth newspapers of the time, but it was basically forgotten until UPI picked up the story in 1973 and wrote a big headline of a pre-1900 space traveler that crashed and was buried in a local Texas cemetery. When they did that, people started coming to Aurora from all over the country with picks and shovels, determined to dig him up. And of course, the city council got involved and put armed guards in the cemetery to deter anybody from trying to do this at night. But unfortunately, the original marker that was carved for him in 1897 when they buried him was stolen in 1973. So it hadn't been seen since then. All there are a lot of pictures of it.
Yeah, well, and one of the other unique things, and this was actually brought up in a television show a lot later when I actually caught on to the Aurora and did a little bit of research on it, was the wreckage of the crash was supposedly buried under the damaged windmill, if I remember right, that it hit. They took a lot of it, and then, they buried it under there and sealed it off. Now, I know that's all hearsay. There's not really a lot of proof involved in that, but there's been stories about how some of the wreckage has caused radiation leaks around the area and so forth. So it's kind of an interesting story.
Yeah, they as the story goes, they dumped the wreckage of the craft in an abandoned well, and it poisoned the well. And a guy that was living there in the 1950s came down with this horrible arthritis that crippled him, made his fingers swell up terribly.
Yeah, it hit the windmill that was above the well, I think is what it was, on Judge Proctor's property, and then they took it and buried it in the well. Of course, it capped off the well after the claims. But it's still kind of interesting that that the story still pertains to an arthritic case and the fact that, hey, look, there might be something here. When you were actually – I'm assuming when you wrote the book, you probably did an incredible amount of research to make sure that when you wrote your historic content along with your story itself, that you tried to be as accurate as you could. Did you go out and actually spend some time at the area and do some interviews and kind of really dig into it?
No, I didn't. But what I did do was I scrounged up everything on Aurora that I could and read through it and through UFO reports and files. And I had the pleasure of speaking to Jim Mars a couple years ago when I was in the finalization stages. And we spoke a little bit about what happened and what he thought happened, and if he thought it was really true. And of course, he did really think it was true because he'd done a lot of research on that. He'd done documentaries, he'd done magazine articles, so he was very helpful. And I tried to treat the 1897 sections of the book with the utmost respect and to get them historically accurate. I tried to envision how the people of the time would cope with such an event, how they would react, and what they would do, and what they would say, and what they would think. So, the 1897 sections, I tried to pay homage to the crash and get as historically accurate as possible.
Well, it would be interesting to really dive into a situation like that. I know I've done it a lot in the paranormal and some crypto, like the Mothman and so forth. And it's kind of amazing when you start to research and everything. If you get a chance to go out and speak to the public, it becomes even more amazing. I know that the Dallas TV station, KDFW, they did air a very lengthy report, like you mentioned, on Aurora, where Richard Ray interviewed the Fort Star Telegram. Jim Mars, I do believe, was the local guy that he interviewed at the time and talked about the report a little bit, as well as many other investigations that that touched base with the historical nature and how it was so unique. And one has to think, like you said, Roswell is a big incident. Everybody knows about Roswell. Everybody talks about Roswell. And being connected to some of the people that I have throughout the years that have worked at Roswell, actually, I tend to think that there's a lot of confusion within the UFO community a lot of times with that. But this particular incident, there's no way to confuse it. I mean, it was before a lot of modern things were around, and there were a lot of local witnesses, so to speak, that were very creditable.
Yeah, it was before the feds could run in there and cover it up. It was before all these theories and stuff would come along. So yeah, it was at a primitive time. I mean, it wasn't that long after the Civil War, and they were as I did my research for the novel, I found hundreds of accounts UFOs that were spotted and landed, and extraterrestrials that were seen in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, leading up to Aurora.
That's an interesting thing in itself. I know that listeners, a lot of times, if you don't do a lot of UFO research, you'll find that when you start digging into UFO research and you actually get into a lot of the old news articles, a lot of the old papers, a lot of the old stories and so forth, there are an incredible amount of claims about how unusual devices have landed, flown in the skies, exited from time to time, and descriptive nature sometimes, and actually what some of these creatures look like, what the crafts look like, and so forth. So when you get back as far as Aurora, like Carrie's saying, you know, this is a time where the government really didn't have the FBI. They barely had a CIA, so to speak, and most of that revolved around mostly the war antics and the war situations and local politics more than anything else. So people were free to start talking about these things a little bit more openly than I think they are even in society today, if that makes sense.
Right, right. Here's one of my favorite accounts. This is from September 1864. It talks about a fur trapper named James Looney who watched a skyrocket streak through the sky above the Great Falls, Upper Missouri. Moments later, it crashed with a monstrous explosion that shook the entire forest and emitted such heat on impact that it turned the ground to glass. Now, that was reported in the Cincinnati Commercial. And he was quoted as saying, the next morning, Looney was astonished to find a widespread path of destruction cut through the forest several rods wide. He went on to describe the object at the end of it was divided into compartments and carved with hieroglyphics similar to those found in the writings of ancient Egypt. Now, this was straight out of the paper in 1864.
Huh. And that's actually kind of interesting. The descriptive detail is actually kind of unique in itself when you're talking about the hieroglyphics. Now, I don't know how many of my listeners actually look into UFOs or not. I know we've covered it several times here on Paranormal Truth and Reality, along with a lot of different things. But one of the key aspects that have been throughout the UFO culture for at least 40 years, if not 50 years, is the hieroglyphs. There's been different presentations of how the hieroglyphs look, but a lot of times they will talk about it being similar to Egyptian hieroglyphs and sometimes early Grecian hieroglyphs, depending on how you look at them. It's a very interesting story when you start getting back into the 1700s and 1800s, and people are describing what a lot of us, if you don't know any better, a lot of us didn't pick up until, what, 1970 to 1980 when people started looking into it again?
Right, right. And even the Aurora crash, they mentioned in the newspapers that they found, now they called them papers or documents. They said that the traveler that crashed had documents that were written in symbols that they could not read. So it's basically the same thing. They didn't even know to use the word hieroglyphics, but it was symbols that were of an unknown origin that they couldn't decipher. And that's commonplace with this as far back as history goes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, even some of the Egyptian culture and even if you look at some of the Aztec culture and the Mayan cultures, if you actually looked at the hieroglyphs that they put together, from time to time, you see a lot of similarities where it appears, if you actually look into it in detail, that they're not the only ones writing these. And some of the hieroglyphs that they present are written from what would seem to be something that came from the sky. Of course, they call it a god, but what else would you call it? especially in the early times, if you think about this, if something flies down from the sky, it's got superior technology, and it's writing in a language you can't understand, well, you adapt some of that language to your culture, and it would be basically God.
Right. Well, the UFO reports go all the way back to biblical times. I mean, they were talking about the wheel of fire and chariots of fire and these celestial craft that took them to the heavens and all. So, I mean, it's been going on for thousands of years.
Now, one has to ask, actually, when you think about that, because it does go back in history for billions of years, even before Christ, some of the early writings picture in their images things that appear to come from the sky in one way, shape, or form in virtually every culture. One has to ask if they haven't been here the whole time. And that's that's something you see in the UFO community all the time. You see a curiosity in everybody all the time. I myself have been curious about that all the time. You know, it's just unique. Sure, it could be a lot of human interest and misconception, but you know, all these cultures didn't start relating with each other until many, many years later and traveling their different stories. So from early times when they're not relating with each other quite as well because you can't travel that far, you're still seeing the same thing.
Right. Yeah. No, there've been reports of travelers in the sky for thousands of years. Look at the Nazca lines. I mean, they're not even sure how old the Nazca lines are. And, they had no idea they were even there until aerial flight started going above them and looking down. You know, you couldn't tell what that was from the ground.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And it's actually amazing if you haven't looked into the Nazca lines, it's almost impossible not to have looked at it somewhere along the line. It's been all over television for anybody that's ever looked into the paranormal or UFOs or even ancient history. From time to time, it comes up on the History Channel, comes up everywhere. But if you haven't looked into it, I encourage you to do so. It's actually quite amazing because some of the depicted detail of the animals and the creatures and the lines are pretty precise for being on the ground and not being able to see it from the sky.
Right. And the astronaut, you know, there's one that he has a complete suit on, the helmet, the face shield, and everything.
Yeah, it's literally, it looks like a little miniature astronaut, kind of. I mean,
looks like a little miniature astronaut. And their depictions of grays in ancient Egypt inside the pyramids or inside some of those, I saw one online just a couple weeks ago, and it was the perfect image of a gray right next to one of those Egyptian gods, and it was carved on one of the walls.
Well, there are depictions of what could be considered grays in a lot of different cultures, not only just Egypt, but on the Mayan temples, you'll see certain images that could very easily resemble what would be a gray. It's a larger head, larger eyes, smaller body. I think I've seen it in the some of the Celtic and even American Indian, believe it or not, caves, you'll see little depictions that if you look at it, it could resemble an alien as we're speaking of it today. It's just a little different in each one, but it sure could be the same thing. They all have large heads. They all have big eyes.
Right. The typical description.
Yeah, the typical description. Now, I, being from a little bit of a military background, I don't know personally whether I believe in grays or not, but I do believe that it's very naive of anyone to think that we're the only intelligent life out there. And it's also naive to believe that that intelligent life hasn't visited us somewhere along the line, or even consider that we wouldn't be here without them, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And here I got another little sighting here, if you want to hear it, from 1896, November 25th, 1896. A Colonel H.G. Shaw, traveling in his horse-drawn carriage, came across three hairless beings. he quoted as saying, they had tiny ears and stood along the road while their huge cigar-shaped craft hovered behind them over a lake. When asking where they were from, Shaw was reported to have been unable to understand their warbling chant, but stated each had a bag under their arm attached to a nozzle from which they breathed and carried something about the size of a hen's egg, which emitted an immense penetrating light. After a time, the three walked rapidly toward their ship, opened the door on the side, and disappeared within. The ship then went up and through the air rapidly, soon out of sight. So there again, there's one from 1896, November 1896. And again, short beings breathing through apparatuses. You know, they get in their craft and they take off.
Yeah, and I think that logically that's probably what we're going to experience if we have any type of intelligent contact somewhere along the line. We always assume that intelligent contact and alien life is going to present itself a lot like humanity, if that makes sense.
Right.
Now science has learned that a lot of alien life we've encountered so far is not quite that, but it's also proven that alien life does exist. We have now found biological life. We have now found viral life. So we know that alien life can exist outside of the planet Earth. So if that's possible, then it is possible for alien life to show up. Now, I think our first contact is probably going to be similar to what we've imagined already, because from the looks of it, it's already been here before. And that's in the smaller beings, the more, they're not going to quite be the same size we are, and they are going to be slightly different. Like you said, they're going to be hairless. The colors vary. We've gotten to the silver gray skin throughout history, but if you look deep enough, like you said, some of the depictions aren't necessarily giving you a color of skin.
Right.
But it is obvious that that something has been here before, and odds are is going to come back again, or does come back. All the way from the early times, all the way up to the more recent times. And even in the 1940s through the 1970s, give or take, when we started talking about the inner Earth theory, we started talking about the pilot that was up in the Antarctic and found the big hole. The Germans went up there and so forth. It's an amazing culture in history that no matter how far you dig in, you're going to find something every single time that makes you wonder.
Right.
I'm a big one on the Black Knight. I've researched that about 1,000 times, and I know people say it's space crap, but I've looked at all the images. I've looked at the NASA reports and their reports. I've looked at all of the other situations, and I really think there's something more there than we're being told.
Well, that's the case most of the time with those kind of things. I just saw a report and a video on the Russian UFO that they found back in the 80s. The KGB, they found that saucer that crashed and flipped and landed up against a row of trees. And the video from it is pretty amazing. It definitely looks like a crashed flying saucer, if you will. And that's just one of thousands of reports like that.
It is actually a very amazing video once you start looking at it. I mean, there's a lot of detail there. it looks like it's a crashed UFO. The way it crashed, it would be hard to reproduce that. You could with our technology today, but it would be hard to reproduce the little bit of video that's there and the little bit of imaging that's there.
My question is, why would the KGB go to that kind of trouble to do that? They wouldn't. They have no interest in that kind of thing.
Yeah, in order for somebody that's not KGB to do it, to be frankly honest with you, it would just cost too much. Why would you want to create that elaborate of a hoax just to throw it out to the public?
Right. It isn't like they did it and then released it the next week and says, look, we found this. I mean, it was years before that video was ever seen. It was put away and it was, you know, it took decades for that to even come around. So there would be no profitability at all in them making that up to just lock it away somewhere.
No profitability, no logic to it, no reasoning to it. I mean, it would just kind of be a waste.
Right.
There's a lot of that that's now being released, though. Even some of the documents that are slowly coming out paint a unique picture that we've known in the governments for quite a long period in time, that there is something flying around that we have no idea what it is. I was just reviewing some of those documents, and I can't remember exactly where it is, but it's an Air Force base here in the United States that they covered up for a long time. Then they just released last year and the year before a whole series of documents from this that literally state that it is a UFO. It's unidentified. It doesn't come from any ground sources. It cannot be identified from coming from any of our alternative countries. And it's not, you can't pick it up on radar. It was physically seen by the people at the Air Force base.
Was that the 1964 landing where it landed and the president supposedly had a meeting with them?
Nope, it wasn't that one. It was actually another one, 1971 or 72, I think, is when this report was one. I read a little bit about that one. I swayed away from that one a little bit because of the strange nature of it, but it is an interesting story.
Well, I found a quote from John F. Kennedy that I put in the front of my book under him. But my hands are tied. So he knew, he knew back then what was going on. But of course, his hands were tied. He couldn't say anything about it, especially then.
Yeah, well, if you think about it, and I've had this discussion many times, a lot of people think it's a massive conspiracy from the United States government, and it is in a way, covering up all of this from the public. But if you look at it from their eyes and you think about it a little bit, you've got unidentified objects flying around that you can't really spot. You can't trace them. You can't track them. You don't know if they're going to be dangerous. They could very well be dangerous to the United States and other countries. So the first instinct of any government when you find something like that is to not release it to the public, because it could cause a panic. It could cause a lot of other things.
Because they can't control it. They don't want the public to know that there is something out there that they have absolutely no power to control, because it makes them look weak. It makes them look helpless. And in that situation, they pretty much are, but they don't want to admit that. So, yeah, that has a lot to do with the cover-up.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the key thing. They don't want to admit it. They're supposed to be the power and control. They're supposed to tell you, don't worry, you're safe in your home. But when you run into something that's that powerful, and you have to come back and say, well, sorry, you may not be safe in your home. These things could cook us tomorrow. It becomes a nature for them to cover it up. And then once it's covered up 1,000 times and blacked out 1,000 times, sometimes throughout history, the people that take control of the reins, just they don't know what to think of it anymore.
I know what you mean. You're absolutely right.
I've seen that quite a lot. I've met a lot of people throughout the years. I did some subcontracting with the Department of Defense for years, met some very unique people, and I met some very interesting people. Now, I will tell people one thing about the United States government and some of the people that are in official offices that run across this. A lot of people think that they're just going to come back and they're going to laugh about it, and they're going to say, no, it never happens. But you'd be surprised how many officials are actually interested in this, which tells you something right off the bat, even if they won't comment on it.
they're very interested in it. It's a fascinating subject when you think about it, and it's something that you people live in the ordinary world of every day. They experience what they know. They accept what they know, and for them, and this is something that's very, very hard to accept. So unless they just are forced to, most people just overlook it. They just look the other way. They either really interested in it, or they just don't want to hear about it because it's too much for them.
Yeah, well, yeah, and if you think about it, and some people, whether it be UFOs or otherwise, sometimes it just becomes so much that their perception of reality can be broken. And if you think about it, though we don't see it on a regular basis, what would happen tomorrow if a large craft just came down and landed and said, "Hey, you're not alone in the universe." And right. yeah, we're more technically advanced than you. Well, that's scary.
Yeah. It is, and it would cause so much trouble, so much panic, so much so many questions. I'm sure the government sure don't hope that don't happen tomorrow.
And if they do know what's going to happen, one would think that there'd be a lot of preparation before they would allow it to hit the public, because you're going to have two sides of it. You're going to have some people that openly accept it and say, "This is awesome. We know we're not alone anymore." And if they're not going to attack us, well, maybe we'll learn something. And you're going to have other people that are going to get so scared, they're going to automatically go into, they want to take us over, they want to use us, they want to kill us.
Right.
Because of the human nature factor. I mean, we see that on TV all the time. You don't often see a alien movie that says, "Oh, look, I'm coming down and it's peaceful and everybody's going to be happy for the rest of their life."
Right. Yeah. And you don't see that very often. And that's one thing that I tried to do in my book. I tried not to sensationalize, panic and fear and, shoot 'em up, bang 'em up, space, you know, the aliens blowing up the world and all that. I tried to keep it really simple, really calm, really to the historical fact. You know, this alien lost control. He crashed. He died, and they buried him. That's the extent of it. That's what I want. That was the message that I wanted to get across. That it was a simple event that happened, and the people dealt with it at the time as best they could.
Well, if you actually think about it, it shows the kind nature of humanity. That town and those people could have panicked. They could have burnt it and done all kinds of other things. But did they? Nope. They gave it the same rite of passage they would have given any one person in that town.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually a very good story if you think about it, which is overlooked quite a lot if you ask me. But these people came together even though they saw something that was foreign, that could have been a danger, that could have been considered evil, considered the times, because we have a lot of belief systems at that point in time. And instead of opening it up as something terrifying, they did a kind act.
Right. Yeah, they didn't know where he was from. They didn't know what he was, but they knew he wasn't from our world. But yet they did what they could do for him. They gave him a Christian burial, and that's exactly what it said in the newspaper. He'll be buried tomorrow with Christian rites. And it just shows the goodness of the people of the time to do for this poor soul, no matter what he was, what they could do.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I think that's an amazing story in itself that that can be spread on the positive light. And a lot of people look at UFO stories and they think about the crashes and they think about the government's conspiracies and they think about all the negative things, but that's a positive thing.
Right.
and perhaps that's why it was overlooked.
A minute ago, you were talking about technology. You know, secrets revealed from the Roswell craft ultimately led to the development of such items as lasers, fiber optics, particle beams, night vision technology, bulletproof Kevlar, and all kinds of things for the Department of Space-related defense. All this and more was harvested and developed from the advanced technology found at the wreckage of the Roswell crash.
Yeah, reverse engineering. And listeners, so that you know a little bit, I know that this has been discussed for many, many years, but there are actually documents that have been released in the past year that do insinuate that some things that were reverse engineered are what we're using today in our technology. And some of it's been admitted now, and some of it supposedly, according to everything that's been talked about with the government, is going to be released and admitted later that, yes, we did find out how to do certain things by reverse engineering technology that we have no idea where it came from. Even though they blacked out most of that, it's still there.
I have
no doubt that some of that is 100% true. I mean, we had to come across some of these things we use today by accident, and some of it not so much by accident. It's already been admitted that some of the frequencies we've came across were from unidentified origins and unidentified natures that did not come from Earth. And now we're utilizing them today. So why not Kevlar? Why not night vision? Why not a lot of the other things?
Yeah. Well, in my research, I read The Day After Roswell, and the guy that wrote that, you know, he was real active in all of that, and he saw a lot of that in development. So that's where I got my information, and he's been pretty looked at as respectful in this aspect. So I have no reason to doubt it at all.
Well, human instinct would state that that's the first thing. If I were in a technological era and I was a part of the government, I mean, human instinct would tell me that if I found something that I couldn't explain, that I couldn't identify, that I couldn't, you know, I already know it's a danger. We just got lucky and it crashed, so to speak. We've seen it before. Why wouldn't I tear it apart to try to figure out how it works?
Right, and that's one of the main reasons the government is so thirsty to get to it and to keep it quiet and to lock it away, where they can reap the rewards from it. You know, that's a gift from the heavens. So they want to get that and haul it away and dissect it and learn all they can learn from it. I mean, that's just good business. But that's it's not just the cover up. It's the fact that they want to gain as much knowledge from it as possible.
Well, that's the thing. They want to gain as much knowledge from it as possible. A lot of times with the early government, not necessarily the government now, because our wheels have changed motions, but in the early government, it was probably more out of fear. Because we have no idea whether these things are going to attack. We have no idea whether they have positive notions, negative notions. So let's tear apart what we can to figure out what we're dealing with. Throughout the years, that's changed because our government's changed and our society's changed a little bit. Now we're a little bit more money driven. We're a little bit more power driven. So if we come across something now, we're more likely not to worry about it being fear because our egos are a little bit bigger. But, hey, right. How can we manipulate this and use this so that we have the next tool we can use against everybody else?
Right. If there's something to be learned from it, we want to be the ones to learn.
Yeah. We don't want to share it with anybody else. We want to be the first ones to learn it and use it. And that's where a lot of the conspiracy comes in, because it's not really that they're hiding things from the human nations. For the aspect of our own good. They're hiding it for the aspect of their own power, their own money, whatever they can utilize it for at the time. You know, that happens outside of UFOs. That happens in human culture all the time. People come run with an idea and they'll hide it for years from everybody because I can capitalize it over here and make a boatload of money.
It is amazing
though. It is amazing. I love the UFO culture. It's an astounding situation. I just spoke about 4 weeks ago with a gentleman that he believes that they came early on, and that's how we advanced the way that we advanced, and that they've taught us many, many things that have been lost throughout the years. And he's actually writing a book on that right now. But it's a very interesting theory that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Makes perfect sense. A lot of the technology, levitation, for example, has been lost, which is how a lot of the great Egyptians and monument builders of the prehistoric times built all these things out of these stones that even with today's technology, we couldn't move around.
Uh-huh.
But at the beginning of the show, you were asking me what prompted me, what interested me so much to get started on a work like this. See, I had a UFO experience of my own when I was 9 years old. I grew up in Commerce, Georgia, which is a little town between Atlanta and Greenville, South Carolina. And in 1973, my father had he worked for the police department for 19 years. He had a realistic brand scanner. And for weeks and months, 1973 was just a hotbed for UFOs all over the country and in Georgia. There had been reports for weeks and months of low-flying craft in the area. And one night, all that came to a head that they said callers, frantic residents were calling in saying that a flaming object had landed in the parking lot of the medical center clinic. Well, that medical center clinic was the same hospital complex my mother worked at. So we went tearing off over there in her 1969 green panel station wagon. And there was a fire truck and two police cars and a few other spectators that had obviously heard the same thing. And there was no UFO in the parking lot. But what was truly amazing was there was a 30-foot circle, smoking hot, with drips of molten metal all the way around the outside of the circle. And
wow.
It had just about melted the blacktop inside the circle. And this is not something that I saw on the news or read in the newspaper. This was something I saw with my own two eyes. And then, mysteriously, 3 days later, in the middle of the night, on a Sunday night at that, the entire parking lot was repaved. Some organization moved an asphalt crew in there in the middle of the night and completely resurfaced that parking lot to cover up any trace of what that could have possibly been.
You know, that's amazing. That's a once in a lifetime eyewitness account, I guess you could say, because you physically were there and saw the proof that, by God, something landed there. You may not have seen the object, but it's kind of hard to not know that something quite large landed and caused an effect that was very hot and very disturbing. And now, no less than, would you say, 3 days later, the whole thing just seems like it never happened.
Right. And not only did the object land and burn the big hole, but it was in a very short time that those calls came into the police department. And we responded, which couldn't have been more than 8 or 9 minutes from beginning to end. So whatever it was, wasn't there for very long. It sat down and it obviously lifted back off again pretty quickly. Now, 12 miles from Commerce, Georgia, in 1973, as a matter of fact, I think it was June 1st or July the 1st, there was a documented landing of a UFO that several people actually witnessed it when it went down and saw it, and you know that was there for a little while. And that was and Danielsville, Georgia is 12 miles from Commerce. So literally in the same area, 12 miles span apart, the same year. So there was a lot of activity in 1973, especially in my part of the country. I live in Pennsylvania now, but I was born and raised down in Georgia. I never remember a year like 1973 again, as far as activity.
No, that's an amazing story. I had not even close to being similar, but I had an incident when I was 16 years old outside of my own home, and I always got laughed at about it. Some people still laugh at me today about it, but it was definitely a UFO incident. I can't tell you what it was. And I tell people many, many times, sure, it could have been a government thing or so forth. But we were actually out on an old Pinto at the time, me and my friend, just kind of chilling out at the stars. And of course, at that time here in Ohio, there weren't a lot of houses around my home. So you could look for miles out to fields. There were no trees, just a bunch of cornfields. This time of year, it was empty. And we see this little light come down miles and miles away, and it's shining a light below it. So you can see the light come down, and it's almost like you were taking a spotlight and hitting the ground, right? Really bright. And it flew very, very quickly. When it stood there for about 20 minutes, and we're sitting there going, is that an airplane? Is that a helicopter? Is it hovering? It changed a few different colors on the lights, and then it flew very quickly above us, and we were blinded. Now, this seemed like a couple of seconds, but it happened at 12:05 a.m. And when we come to, we look at the clock and it says 12:35 a.m. So we lost a period in time between it flying above us and looking at the clock and then looking at the clock again. And I've always kept that in the back of my mind because that's the closest thing I've ever had to a UFO experience. But how else can you explain it?
Right. And the lapse of time is a common factor in a lot of the sightings. They lose minutes, sometimes hours, and it's still not explained why, but that explanation has came up a lot of times as people lose time when they get in those situations.
Yeah, and it's became common knowledge that you lose that. It's just in my particular incident, you know, you hear all of these stories, and it's just like ghost stories, and it's just like Bigfoot encrypted stories and everything. You hear all these stories, but the average person remains skeptical because it's in human nature. So until it happens to you, you just listen to it and go, oh, yeah, whatever.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. People believe what they see with their own eyes. If they can't see it or experience it, they have problems, especially with something as far out as the subject of extraterrestrials landing around the country.
Oh yeah, yep. Or abductions, or UFOs of any sort. It's almost like cryptids. UFOs and cryptids, when it comes to skeptics, are almost hand in hand. People look at UFOs sometimes the same way they look at Bigfoot. You know, right. Everybody's got a Bigfoot story, but yeah, it doesn't really exist.
Right.
But when you experience it, how else are you going to explain it? Because now you've seen something that it just goes beyond reason.
Nothing will make you a believer any quicker than to see it with your own two eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm a firm believer in that, listeners, because most of my experiences have ran around the UFO situation and the paranormal, as well as ghosts and so forth. So being in it for 23 years, I've seen some things that I just simply can't explain. And I'm extremely skeptical. I try to reason away everything by science and whatever I can. But sometimes, no matter where you go, you're going to run into a situation, and it's not everybody in the public. But you'll run into something you can't explain. There's just no way to explain it.
You know, speaking of ghosts and paranormal, in the mid-1990s, see, I bought, sold, and restored antique cars for most of my life, for over 30 years. And I had went up to Circleville, Ohio, to set up for the Xenia Ford show, and this is about 1994-95. A good friend of mine was the coordinator for the show, and he lived in a three-story house that was a documented haunted house in Circleville. And we stayed there with him for a week while we were setting up the show field. And one night he told us the story. They had moved in this house, had no idea it had any paranormal activity behind it. Well, the doorbell began to ring at all hours of the day and night, and nobody was at the door. So he took the doorbell out, and he took all the wires loose, and it continued to ring. So they call the electrician to see, you know, come over and fix whatever was going on. And the electrician was quick to tell them, said, look, it is not electrical in your house that's wrong. So that house has been rewired three times since, you know, in the last 100 years to try to stop this problem. He says, that's the ghosts of them old women that live there. And the story went, he found this out later, two old maids that were descendants of the founders of the town. One went out to the edge of town and built the three-story house he was living in. Another one, not to be outdone, bought the property directly across the street and built a small castle, which today is the Castle Inn in Circleville, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
And the one in the castle, she would waddle across the street and ring the doorbell, knowing that the other sister stayed on the third floor, you know, liked to stay on the third floor of her house. So by the time she took the elevator down to the first floor and got to the door, the one sister had waddled all the way back across the street and out of sight. Well, they did this kind of thing to torment one another all their lives. And it was one of those two ghosts of the girls, of the sisters, that were ringing that doorbell. And when he disconnected the doorbell, it really pissed that spirit off. And one night, it showed itself to him out in his shop and just scared the ever-living daylights out of him. So he hooked the doorbell back up and never saw the spirit again. And the doorbell continued to ring every once in a while. And he's the kind of guy, he's a no-nonsense. He wouldn't believe that kind of thing for nothing. And he sure wouldn't make anything like that up. But he was a firm believer in that after what had happened in the house he lived in. So I thought that was a great story. And I'm actually writing a screenplay on that basis now.
Circleville, Ohio has an outstanding amount of haunted places, from the castle that you mentioned to the Samuel Moore House. I do believe their town hall, if I remember right, Memorial Hall. Yeah, the Circleville Memorial Hall. I had to remember that is claimed to be haunted. The courthouse is claimed to have hauntings from the 1845 through 1888 incidents. There's a lot of different things within Circleville that are amazing. Ohio itself has a wonderful haunted history, though. We're overlooked a lot of times, but it doesn't matter where you go here in Ohio, you will find something haunted.
Yeah. Well, I remember staying up there with him and doing the show at Xenia, and all these years later, I remember that story as if he told it to me yesterday. It was so fascinating. And coming from a staunch non-believer, no-nonsense kind of guy, and he tells you something like that, and he really means it, that says a lot. You know, it ain't like somebody just making up some story to entertain with. This was a guy that, he had no interest in the subject, but this was an experience that he'd had, that he'd seen with his own eyes. So it made a believer out of him pretty quickly.
Well, that's one of the things I actually learned from traveling around and speaking to people in the paranormal culture in general throughout the years. And, of course, I started with my own experience. I won't get into that much now, but I always share it with the public. So if you're ever interested, I'll be glad to tell you about it. The culture is just wonderful, and everybody has a story. I know we're coming down to our last couple of minutes, and it's been a wonderful discussion with you, Kerry. So let's take a moment to actually stop and talk about where everybody can find you, where they can find your books, and where they can find your websites if you have any, so that way people can actually read your new book that you're going to be writing, as well as your other book, and know a little bit more about you.
Well, the name of the book is Traveler, and it's on Amazon, and it's under my name, Kerry, K-E-R-R-Y, Trent Haggard. And it's, again, it's through Flying Disc Press in England, Philip Mantle. And it's on Amazon, and I'm working now to get it in Barnes & Noble and a couple of other places, but, of course, that takes some time. And I am filming a television show over here in Pittsburgh called Wheels of the Past, where we celebrate, antique cars with great stories to tell, like, the surviving 58 Plymouth Fury used in the making of Christine. We're going to do an episode on the John Dillinger Hudson Essex Terraplane. We're going to do an episode on Bonnie Carr. We went down to the Corvette Museum and filmed an filmed an episode where they had the sinkhole swallow up eight of their show cars. So we're working on that and trying to get it going and doing all this other stuff at the same time with Traveler. I'm going to be in New Jersey July 27th, 28th, 29th, I believe, at the MUFON Nationals in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I'm also going to be in at the MUFON Convention in Philadelphia, October 26th and 27th, and the one in Pittsburgh, October the 20th.
Beautiful. Well, listeners, you've actually heard where to find Kerry. Make sure that you look him up, obviously, on Amazon. And if you're actually at the conferences, you know, don't hesitate to stop by and say hi to him. It's been a wonderful experience with you, Kerry. Next week, so that everybody knows, I have a delightful young lady that does her own podcast, has her own paranormal investigation team, and is fairly well known throughout the community, Kat Hobson. I encourage you to listen to that. You've been listening to Paranormal Truth and Reality here on BBS Radio. BBS is one of the largest radio stations when it comes to digital in the United States. So if you're ever thinking about doing a digital radio show, go with the best. Shoot for Donald and go with BBS. Kerry, I want to thank you for coming on. You've been a wonderful guest. You're always welcome to come back on and talk about your new book or anything else that you want. Just shoot up my assistant and we'll be glad to put you back on the show. I'm going to end this the way I do every single week, everybody. In the paranormal, as you're noticing from speaking to an author that spent a lot of time in research, paranormal should always be that truth and reality around you. So before you jump straight into the media and the assumptions, take the time to research, take the time to look, and take the time to look into history. There's an amazing culture, an amazing amount of history that gets lost through the mix. We'll let you off of here. We'll talk to you next week. Enjoy your weekend.